Hi, I'm Guy Powell, and welcome to the next episode of The Backstory on the Shroud of Turin. If you haven't already done so, please visit guypowell.com and sign up for more episodes. I am the author of the new book, The Only Witness, a historical fiction tracing a possible history of the Shroud over the last two millennia. Today, we're speaking with Mary Hines, and she is a longtime researcher and speaker on the Shroud. And today we're going to be talking about some of the things that she's learned as part of her study and promotion of the Shroud of Turin. So let me tell you a little bit about Mary. She has been on the front lines of Shroud research and Shroud promotion. So she is a retired medical technologist, and she has done Shroud research since 1977. And is a member of the Shroud Sciences Group, the SS Group. Father Rinaldi, who organized the team of American scientists for research on the Shroud, invited Mary to be his personal guest to view the Shroud in Turin, Italy in 1978. And I must say, I am very jealous that she had the opportunity to view it personally. And actually more than once. So we're going to hear more about that. But welcome, Mary. So good to have you.
Thank you, Guy.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about your backstory on how you got involved in the Shroud of Turin.
Well, I had gone to Jerusalem the year previous. And that's a very significant part of the story, actually, because when I went to Jerusalem, I had taken some tapes with me and recordings and camera and all that stuff. And to record everything that the scripture scholar, Stephen Doyle, was going to tell us, because having gone to Catholic schools, I didn't know very much about the scriptures. So I figured I'd have to keep listening and re-listening to them to learn about them. And while there in Jerusalem, and where I was taping everything, this person came over and asked me if she could come to my home afterwards and copy the tapes. And my thought was, oh no, I've done all this work. I'm not just going to hand those over like that. No way. But inside my heart, I'd say with the ears of my heart, I heard this little voice say, the tapes are not just for you, Mary. They're for others too. So I relented, and the person's name was Mary Campbell. And she played a very prominent role after that in me getting to see the Shroud. As I said, it all began in Jerusalem. And she got my phone number so she could come to my house and copy them. And we had a few phone calls here and there when I got home from Jerusalem. And I was a secretary for the parish council in my hometown of Reading. And while there at a meeting, the president gave me this photo of the face of the Shroud. And I looked at the picture and I thought, all I can say is, like, you know, you see a picture, someone looks familiar to you and you want to put a name with the face. And that's how I kind of felt. But it kind of, looking at the face, it kind of mesmerized me. So I thought I ought to follow up on that and see what this is all about. And I went out looking for the books. And there was really not much written, just Dr. Babette's Doctor on Calvary, and a new book had come out, It Is the Lord, by Father Rinaldi. So I bought both books. And while reading Father Rinaldi's book, I had come to a place where he had really getting into how heavy the torture was. You know, the scourging and all the other things that happened. And it sort of jettisoned me right back to the places in Jerusalem. I could see that, I think it was called the El Moriah Schoolyard or something, where Jesus was scourged. And it made it very real and vivid to my mind. The awful torture that goes with crucifixion. And it's, I felt, even now when I'm talking about it, I can almost sense like I was there and saw it happening to him. And I felt like I wanted to take this beaten down body, bleeding, and take it home, put it in a tub, and clean him up, and cover the wounds with bacitracin, put him to bed with some ice cold water, and give him a Bufferin, and let him go to sleep. And right after that, I had this experience while reading, and I thought, and it really, gosh, I can feel myself going back there to that time now, just in speaking about it. So I thought about it and thought about it for a while. And then when Mary called, I told her, I said, Dia, have you ever heard of the Shroud of Turin? Now she's coming to copy the tapes, okay? And she says, oh yeah, I've heard of that. And I said, what do you know about it? She said, well, not too much. And I said, I went out and got some books. And I was reading this book by Father Rinaldi, and I had this really big experience, but I never told her what it was. And she said, oh, and she didn't ask. And that, you know, that was it on that. And then she was, this is probably, it was a while, 6 or 7 months after we had gotten home. Our trip had been in September of 76. And then I got the picture of the face of the shroud probably early to around spring of 77. So about the time she was coming to copy the tapes, I had received a phone call from Father Peter in Turin inviting me to come and see the shroud. And I thought, wow. And then I thought someone was playing a prank on me or something like that. But he definitely had an accent. And in those days, you could almost hear it was coming long distance on the phone. And I said, okay. And he gave me the date and everything else, you know, that he'd be available and all. And he'd pick us up at the airport or whatever. And he gave me telephone numbers to contact him, all these things. By the time I hung up, I thought, oh, I'd just love to go, God, but I could never go to Italy by myself. I'd be too scared. I couldn't do that. And I thought, I sent him like, you know, trying to get the light here going. How can you manage this for me, God? I've often said that to him. How can you manage this for me? And he'd give me these ideas. And so he said to me, well, call Mary. Ask her when she's coming, you know, to do the tapes. And I did. And I said, you know, in the conversation, I got this call from Father Turin in Italy to come and see the shroud as his personal guest. I said, but I'm too afraid to go. I'm too afraid to go alone. I don't know what to do about it. And she said, I'll go with you right away. I'll go with you. And I thought, oh, and that took me back a bit. In telling you the story, I'm going through this all over again, and I can feel the feelings of it. And so we made plans to go, and when we did, we went by the way of Rome. We'd spend a week in Rome, and we'd fly up on this Wednesday to Turin, and we'd meet Father Peter. But in the meantime, Father Stephen Doyle, the one that we had gone to Jerusalem with, had given Mary some tickets to go to John Paul I's installation.
Mm.
Well, she was excited about that. And she was a person that could sing very well, and he wanted her to come back on another trip with him to do the singing. And they had become good friends that way. And so we went up on a Wednesday to meet Father Peter. And he met us at the airport. The Salesians don't drive, so his nephew, I think his nephew's name was Paul, if I remember that correctly, they came to meet us at the airport, and they took us to dinner. And during dinner, they have like these long breadsticks at dinner in Italy. So during dinner, he said, "Will you break bread with me, Mary?" And I thought, okay. And right away I thought, you know, just to hear the words break bread, I remember how I met Mary, and she approached me in on Sea of Galilee at the table, and we were having wine, bread, and fish. So, the two kind of went together in my mind, and I thought, oh. And then he leaned over to me, and he said, "The Lord revealed to me what he asked of you." And he got very quiet about it, and then he whispered in my ear, and he gave it to me detail for detail, and I couldn't believe it. I thought, you know, you read about those things in books and things like that, and you know, people that can read hearts and everything, but detail for detail, and I knew this couldn't be a prank, and I knew I hadn't told anybody, so nobody could know. And I remember my knees went weak, and my stomach felt like it was a flip-flop over, and I just felt like I was going to pass out, and I felt ill. So I had asked where the ladies' room was, and he saw me just go pale, and he was going to help me. He's helping this young girl to the ladies' room. And I recovered, but not enough to really follow the rest of the conversation at dinner. I was in a state of fright. I said, you know, you read about these things, but they don't really happen. And I could still feel that happening now talking to you. So he suggested, he said, you have to have a siesta first. And I thought, since I have to wait longer, this is after dinner, I have to have a siesta now. I want to get in there and see that shroud. Because I remember the whole night before, I didn't sleep. I thought, I couldn't have been more nervous if I was going to see Jesus himself. I was so excited. I thought, oh, siesta, 2 hours. He said, in 2 hours, I'll be back and I'll pick you up after the siesta. We'll go over there. And I thought, oh. So for 2 hours, I lay there on the bed. And that was it. And that's when he said, you know, Cardinal Wojtyla is coming. He'll be using the same room tomorrow. And I used to tease people and say, I slept in the same bed as the Pope. Because he became Pope much later. And then look at me kind of strange.
Now that's something.
I shouldn't probably be saying that in this kind of a circumstance, but that is who I am.
That's like in the U.S., George Washington slept here. You slept then where the Pope slept.
But I did the day before.
Yes, very important.
Very important. When I say this to people to get a shock reaction, I don't say the day before, but anyhow, and I never knew he'd be Pope next, my goodness. And I saw him around there because they were all there, you know, to vote that week for John Paul I. And he was there, and then around shaking hands and everything. And so anyhow, after siesta, he brought us in to see the shroud. And there are long, long lines.
Mm.
Long lines coming out, because this was the first time, you know, later they came like in 2 years or 5 years or something. Mm. But this is the first time, I think, since 1933. I'm not sure on that. But it had been quite a while for a public showing.
Well, and plus the cost of travel and everything was so much less and so much easier, and certainly as well the knowledge of the shroud had started to diffuse and come into the U.S. So there were,
in 78, I saw more people in line. The line seemed longer, and we walked right by it all, walked in like we were very important people with Father Peter. And he brought us right down front, you know, and everything. And you have time to stay there and look at it. And it, of course, probably because it was the first time I had seen it, it was a kind of an awesome experience, because I remember looking up at it, and what came to my mind was that all he had done for me to get me there, that all went through my mind. I mean, that's when I thought, well, it was like he was choreographing a movie or something like that, with all the coincidences that had happened. And I was thinking about all the, you know, how he went out of his way. I was thinking of him from a human being point, you know, I think he only went out of his way, and he did this and did that and gave me all these ideas. And then he gives me this personal invitation to come through Father Rinaldi. And Guy, what I really, you asked me on a question once, what did I really feel when I stood before it the first time? And I can honestly say, you know, there's so many people on earth. I feel like a grain of sand, and Jesus on the seashore, and then he picked out this grain of sand that was me. And I felt, it's incredible to kind of explain this. And maybe it's a moment of insanity that I'm doing it, but I felt like he really loved me just the way I am. It was nothing I had to do to earn it. It wasn't anything I deserved. That he really loved me with all my flaws and everything else. It was a different kind of love than I had ever experienced before.
That is an amazing, and it makes so much sense that you know, that your point about being a grain of sand, and you know, we are all grains of sand, and yet he he picks out every piece of grain of sand. God chooses every grain of sand and touches each and every one of them, and then you, in this particular case, he touched you with the opportunity to be able to see the shroud and firsthand, and be able to experience that absolute, you know, unconditional love that God and Jesus has for us all.
And it's indescribable, that kind of, it's just indescribable. And it's not that, like, you know, if I had a lot of money and I was very smart, I could have probably gotten myself there to see it. But to have the way he did it, to have the personal invitation, and to have had the meal beforehand, just like the meal beforehand that I said, all right, you can come and copy the tapes. Because I've had a lot of experiences, but my experiences with Jesus have all mostly been at table. You know, sitting at the table, or talking to people in a one-to-one, or something like that. But I don't think anything will there's one thing that comes close to that, is when I became a mother for the first time and I held the baby. It was an awesome moment that you don't forget. It was the love that you feel for that baby.
Yeah. And that's, miracle, yeah, that's unconditional, miracle, as well.
You know?
Yep.
And I'm not going to cry. Don't do that.
Well, let me change the subject then. But that is a wonderful story. And so how close was that to when the STIRP team did their research? Was that before, or was that after that you got to see the shroud?
I got to see it before the STIRP team. I got to see it in the beginning, and I teased Barry about that. And he handles it well. He says, I know, Mary, I know. He handles it well.
Yeah, he's so funny. That's well, I'm glad you beat him.
And he's been very good to me, supporting me. He made me my PowerPoint and everything. My daughter would say, I had slides at first, you know, it was pre-PowerPoint age, no cell phones.
Yep.
And I can remember my daughter saying, you have to get upgraded to a PowerPoint, Mom. So Barry made me a PowerPoint. And another friend of Barry's and mine, Father Kim Dreismack, oh, he gave me so much background in the scripture and learning about it. And if I didn't have Ian Wilson's book, I wouldn't have known where to begin.
Yeah.
And that book, really, that was my Shroud Bible.
Yeah, that was that's Ian Wilson's The Blood in the Shroud. And it did the same thing for me.
The 1978 one.
Oh, okay. The other one. Yeah. Okay.
The very first one. Yeah. Because I needed something. All I had was Father Rinaldi's book. Mm. And it didn't give you enough that you could assimilate it into yourself to go out to talk about it.
Yeah.
I remember Barry saying to me, you go, one thing you have to be sure of, you have to be very integrous about what you say, because if you mess up once, you lose the integrity.
Yep. Yep.
So, you know, he was a good mentor. And Dorothy and Isabel, Dorothy was a wonderful mentor to me and gave me so much. There was so many people. You start mentioning names and then you forget other people. Of course, Joe. I met him from the beginning. And
Joe Marino. Yep.
He's a dear friend, and he's been very good to me. And
So now you knew Father Rinaldi. Tell us about him, because he's also one of the big names in the Shroud world, certainly.
He kept in touch with me all the time afterwards. I would get notes from him every day. And after I saw the Shroud, and they picked us up, and when he was taking us back to the airport, he said, I'll be sending you all these books. Little did I know. When you're going to be doing lectures, you're going to sell these books. I had no plans on doing anything like that. And so he'd write me each week, and I'd write him. And I must have sold thousands of books when the millions saw the Shroud. And he said, I was going to write about you in that, Mary. But then I thought, well, this was a very special treat you had from God. So I didn't. And he said, but I waved back and forth on it. And I missed him so much when he passed. He was very, very good to me. And there's something else I was going to say. When I was given the lectures, it kind of slipped my mind.
Yeah, no, that's okay. So you've given lectures and you got to visit the Shroud and see the Shroud firsthand. You saw it a couple of times. Now you also have a medical background, and tell us about that and how that's influenced how you view some of the aspects of the Shroud.
When I was first looking at the pictures, that was Father Rinaldi's book, I could see right away the clotted blood from the coagulated blood. I could just tell the difference in that right away. That was evident to me. And then I thought, for someone to have painted that or made it in any way, and it doesn't have the edges to it, where lateral neural inhibition comes into play. You have to stand about 20 feet back or so to really see it, because it doesn't have the borders, and it's a mirror image. And it's I was thinking when I was standing in front of the Shroud, even when I looked up at it, I thought, this is a mind-boggling thing. It seems like the light had to come from within him, because I did belong to a photography club when I was in high school. And I'm not a physicist or anything like that, but a little bit of science in my background, because I, as a medical technologist, I kind of did more hematology than other things. We study cells and the nucleus of cells and then count them. But with the photography background, you just knew this wasn't refracted light like you get from the camera. And it had to be a light within. And it was mind-boggling because after we looked at the shroud, we went back in again. I was sitting in one of the pews, you know, and looking. I said, this is a mind-boggling experience. It just has to be some kind of a light energy. And then I'm trying to think of what was left on the image. And I thought it would have to be an energy that was transformed into another kind of energy. And leaving a residue on the shroud. When that, because the energy, I can remember my son, he had his undergraduate degree and he was a nuclear engineer. And he'd say, Mom, energy always was, it isn't created and you can't destroy it. It just transforms into a different kind of energy. So I've often thought about that with the image on the shroud. And I was thinking about that too, besides feeling so specially loved, but that was a little bit later. I don't know, ask some questions again.
Yeah, sure. I appreciate it.
My long-term memory, because I'm an old lady now.
Well, I'm getting there too. So now you also got to see the Sudarium of Oviedo, the face cloth, and you got to see that. So tell us about that experience.
That was a whole different kind of experience. I went with Dr. Wang. I had put that together, a little trip. And I know Phil Devo was going on that. And I had known him from going to the Dallas conferences. You know, I started out at the SOPUS, the first conference that Marsha insisted I go to. She says, you have to get to know more people and this and that. And that's actually, it was right after that Shroud Group started. It didn't have the name Shroud Group. I think Emanuela decided to get a list of names and she and Julia were going to do something. And I diverted then and I lost track of where I was going.
Yeah, so you went over to Spain and Oviedo. Oh,
yeah, we went over to Spain. We went to see the Shroud too. And then we went to Spain, and that was something else. I knew Mark from another conference some other times, but when we went in there, we got right inside that room, and Mark was standing there, and he had the shroud, not the
and
shroud.
And this is Mark Guskin?
Mark Guskin. He had it, and he had it opened up for us. And I was very close to it. I probably was more close to it than other people and closer than I should have been. So I heard somebody say, don't touch it, Mary. And I thought, I wouldn't have. I would have been too afraid to touch anything that holy. But I wanted to get up close and look at it. And I remember Mark holding it. And that I felt like you came into the presence of something. I felt like I could see the outline of the nose and the mouth, of the lips, you know, and things like that. And I thought, wow, it's just amazing in that I got here to see this and everything. And then we went to lunch, and I hope Mark forgives me for this, but he knew I wanted to touch it and I couldn't. And he said, aha, I kissed it. And I was so jealous. I haven't forgiven him yet for telling me that.
Yeah.
I hope he doesn't watch this.
Well, apparently that is what a lot of people did, was they kissed the sedarium. I imagine they did the same thing with the shroud as well. But what amazes me both on the shroud and also on the sedarium is the evidence of so much blood. And, you know, it's really, and that, you know, that is the Lord's blood right there that, you know, that he sacrificed for us. And that then, you know, of course, is the evidence for that. I think you're right. I've only seen a replica, a beautiful replica of the shroud, and I've seen a good one of the sedarium as well. But the one that really impressed me, and it was only a replica, and yet the calmness and the feeling that you get when you're in front of that image to realize and see all of the things that he suffered on there is very calming, and it brings a totally different feeling over you.
It does. It has like a three-dimensional effect on you. Mm. Like same way if you went in to see one of Monet's paintings, the real one compared to a print.
Yeah.
It's kind of flat, but you see the real thing. But with this, I haven't seen anything that even comes close to the real thing. After 2000, though, the shroud did seem a little bit bleached out to me.
Mm-hmm.
A very good phraseology for explaining it. I couldn't seem to define it the same way, you know, looking at it. I was a little bit disappointed, but I suppose it had to be done.
Mm.
I got a piece of the red silk that it was wrapped up in. Father Noel.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh, that's a big treasure. And he had it stamped and everything. So the only other person I know that has that would be Richard Aurelio had one too.
No kidding.
I thought I was unique, but Richard had one. I don't know where he got his, but he was going back and forth to touring all the time, getting things for his shroud collection.
Well, and that you know, that then would be like a secondary relic because it touched the shroud, and now then, you know, if you've touched that, then I guess that makes you a tertiary relic.
I feel like a relic already. After my 87th year now, I feel like a relic.
Yeah, exactly.
87 until September, but I feel like a relic.
So then, unfortunately, the 1988 radiocarbon testing, how did that affect you when you heard about that?
Well, you know, I never doubted for a second, and I'm a person that doubts things and kind of skeptical, but I didn't doubt for 1 minute. I said, somebody messed up there somewhere, had to be, because all these coincidences, which I would have called the coincidences between Mary and the shroud, all those coincidences could not have come about. And I thought if those coincidences weren't by Jesus directing an MGM production, then the power flowing from the resurrection certainly was. And that was pure energy. And
yeah.
Yesterday, I do these little meditations in the morning, and sometimes I read the things that come to me on email by Bishop Barron. And he had something in there about Jesus lets the world go on, but now and again, he might get in there and adjust a few things for his own purposes. And I thought that's just what Jesus did in my life for me, to get me to see the shroud. And then I told you when I talked to you before, I even have a live witness to all that I'm saying. This person, he's a Franciscan monk, and he went on the trip with me to Jerusalem the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he knew Mary, and he knew about me and the tapes, not wanting to share them, and everything that has followed. And he said, you know, Mary, what I'd say about you, he said, way back when in 1974 and 75, you said you wanted to be an EM. And he said, I told you should be a lector, that you had a gift for proclaiming Christ. And he told me that last night, because I told him I was doing this today. And I thought, wow, I love being a lector.
Mm.
And I said, guess what? I said, you know, when we had our 75th Jubilee back in the hometown in Reading, and the Cardinal was coming, I was asked to be the lector on that. And I said, I do love doing that and the scriptures. And it's sort of an avocation for me now. It's a hobby.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jesus has become a hobby for me. He was when I was younger too, but more so after Jerusalem.
Yeah. Well, and your whole string of connections you know, from the one thing happening to the next, to the next. And, and that is, and then to have your grain of sand being picked out of the beach and things like that. That is such a great metaphor. I really appreciate that. And I kind of agree with you. You know, certainly when I first heard of the, and I wasn't really as studied as I am right now on the shroud, but in back in 1988, when I heard about the radiocarbon testing, I was disappointed. But since then, you know, things, you know, now that radiocarbon testing has been totally debunked, and there's just so many other pieces of evidence that show that the shroud is older than the 1260 to 1390 that came out of that.
Yeah, people seem to want for some reason to hold on to that debunked.
Yeah, and they don't let go. They don't. They're just like grabbing on. And it's, I think that's, you know, it's unfortunate.
But you know, I often would think that to believe it and to really believe some of this stuff, it makes you accountable for yourself. Accountable.
Well, and I kind of feel sorry for those three professors that sat up there on the stage, and behind them on the blackboard they had 1260 to 1390, and you know, I think they took some shortcuts that they should not have taken. Professionally, they took some shortcuts, and it is really a shame.
Well, you're being kind to them saying that. You're being very kind to what I
think. Yeah, I guess so. So,
like Joe Marino, you know.
That result had such an impact on the study of the shroud and everything. It's just hard to believe. But I have so many other questions that I would love to chat with you. But I think maybe we'll do that on the next round. I would love to interview you again. And any last words that you'd like to leave for the listeners?
Well, I think I'd say the shroud found me. Like the grain of sand, and the shroud pursued me, the shroud captured my heart, and I think I'm saying this with my head and heart both together, I know Jesus is Lord.
Yes, what a powerful statement.
Really,
and you
is.
And you're so right. It captured me, the shroud captured me, and Jesus certainly captured me. And I'd like to think he has that grain of sand, my grain of sand with my name on it in the palm of his hand. So absolutely. Well, Mary, let's set up another time to talk further. I really appreciate it. It's been wonderful. And your story of how that feeling of love came over you when you were in front of the shroud, I can only imagine. So I'm looking forward to it at some point, hopefully, to be able to experience that myself.
I'll pray that you do. So watch out.
Yes. Absolutely. Thank you. Well, with that, let me close things out. Mary, so much again. Thank you. And your story and everything. And you've definitely given me a whole new thing to think forward to about experiencing the shroud and stuff like that. And but otherwise, for the audience, please stay tuned. And for the next episode in this series of videos on the backstory on the Shroud of Turin, every one of these, and Mary, such an enlightening and invigorating message that you have. Thank you so much.